Hello and welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. I'm your host, Angela O'Mara. We have such an exciting guest on the show today, Dr. Jonathan Sykes. Dr. Sykes is very, very well known worldwide and throughout the medical aesthetic industry. He is a facial plastic surgeon. He has two practices, one that is located in Roseville, California, the other in Beverly Hills, California. Dr. Sykes is the former director of facial plastic surgery at UC Davis, and he's also the former president of the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery. Dr. Sykes, welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. It's such a pleasure and an honor to have you as a guest today.
Angela, it's my pleasure. I've known you for a lot of years, and I look forward to the next 45 minutes talking about aesthetics and medicine and the changes that have taken place.
Absolutely. Well, today, you know, we know we're going to be talking about truth in advertising as well as patient psychology. And as many of us know, there's truths and untruths, and today we're going to reveal many of those to you. But Dr. Sykes, why don't you just start with, again, telling our audience just a bit more about yourself. I've done an introduction, and, you know, so they can get to know you and perhaps the things that I have not yet mentioned.
Well, I feel lucky to be talking to you today. I've had a long and good career in medicine, and I feel really blessed or just happy to that I'm in the position that I'm in. I went to college in the East Coast at University of Pennsylvania, and I went to medical school at George Washington University. During that time, I incurred a military debt, and that's how I paid for medical school. And then I did my residency before the military obligation was paid at Northwestern. I moved to California because that's where they wanted to station me as a surgeon. So after my surgical residency and my specialty residency, I went to Sacramento, California, and then I did my fellowship there at UC Davis, and I stayed on the faculty, and I was there for 28 years, something like that, a long time, and I had a really good career. During that time, I developed a private practice in a suburb town of Sacramento, and then after leaving UC Davis about 6 years ago, I opened up an office. I'm not sure if that was the smartest thing, but in Beverly Hills, California. So I now run back and forth between the two areas. Additionally to that, I'm an avid teacher, and I lecture a lot on weekends, and have my own Sykes Face Sculpting Institute where I teach anatomy and injection to nurses and doctors. And I'm the medical director of a few medi spas, so I have a lot of things. And lastly, I think you know this about me, Angela, but I'm not sure. I'm a winemaker, so I own a winery in Northern California, and so I make about 5,000 cases of wine per year. So I've got a full life.
You have a very full life, and we're very lucky that you were stationed here in California, so we've got to keep you all these years here on the best coast of the West Coast. That's great. That's great. And to culminate everything, you are a true Californian living in Northern California with your own vineyard. That's fantastic.
Exactly. Yeah, it's been a lucky and hardworking career for me. So
yes, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we, like you mentioned, you know, we've known each other for many, many years, and hopefully many more years. And we've both seen changes within the aesthetic industry, and in specifics with advertising, you know, from the days when, you know, positions did not advertise to now we have social media and Instagram, Facebook, you know, all of these platforms where we can communicate with the world. And so I'd like to kind of hear from you the changes that you feel, you know, we were witnessing or we have witnessed.
Well, I think that the changes are almost expected things based on how widespread the internet is and what our laws are. And the laws are different in different countries, and the way the internet is regulated is different in different countries. But having said that, when I started in medicine, you know, the advertising was sort of started with the yellow pages. Now nobody even has a phone book. And then it sort of transferred to maybe you put an advertisement on the radio, or some people did it on television, or in some kind of print ad, and that got looked at by only a few people. because it was somebody who was watching television then or listening to the radio then. But now the internet is sort of up and up to stay, and everybody has access to it, and we don't really pay for it. We may pay for creating the content, but we don't pay to put it up there. And it's not monitored. It's not, people don't question what gets put up. And I think that it's spurned the ability for people to say what they want about themselves, whether it be true or not.
Yeah.
To really doctor what they put up there. And the public now gets confused. And because the internet is so accessible to both doctors and nurses and to patients, patients also feel like they're doing research. They look around the internet for a while, they're doing research. Well, none of this stuff has had any sanctioning or oversight, and people can put up whatever they want. And what I've looked at, and I'm starting to look at this more closely, is it's almost become commonplace for people to lie about their photographs, which are their calling card. It's their advertisement. And the last time I saw really good before and after photographs that were standardized and consistent, it's very rare that I see that. And what it went from a little bit different, the before to the after, to now the before and afters have different light and different head position, and it almost doesn't look like the same person. And so the thing about before and after pictures, there's almost no honesty in it. And it's almost become okay, acceptable to be dishonest, to trick. We might as well let somebody Photoshop the results in, and it, you know, and when I see good photographs, I almost want to call the person and say, congratulations, not only is your result nice, but so are your photographs. So, and it's not just that, it's what people say about themselves, this perceived excellence or mastery, which we have no way of really monitoring at all. So that to me is, it's the good thing, and the good thing is that there's information out there, and the bad thing that the information is not monitored, and I really see patients getting fooled by what they see. They come in and they say, I want this procedure because somebody showed three good results in a procedure that doesn't really work, right? And it could be a device, it could be whatever. And so it's very, and companies are in the mix too, and they have a lot more resources to advertise than we do. So they realize we can be a little deceiving as well. Maybe flagrant dishonesty might be too strong, but this deceit is there for sure. And it's just an interesting thing that I've sort of witnessed. And what it's allowed is, in the, I won't say the olden days, but formerly, the way that someone built a practice was more organic. It was good results, good word of mouth. And now the word of mouth is whatever you can create on your iPhone. And that's, you know, it's amazing. People don't want to do a surgery without having their videographer there now. It's so different. And they're not really doing this for education. It seems like it's education, but it's advertising. So everything that, my patients come into my office and they say, yeah, I've done my research. No, you got advertised to. And that's, and I don't mean to sound like I have sour grapes. I realize this is a change that's happened, yeah, and it's there. And it's, we're just all living with it, you know, at least in the United States.
Yeah. I think that there's a couple of interesting points that you say that, of course, like, you know, back in the old days, it was just advertising, whether it was print or, you know, television video. And mainly it was print, because to produce, you know, for television, it was so expensive, not just to produce, but, you know, television quality, but to actually buy airtime on shows that gave you, or stations that gave you, such a big audience. You know, I do understand, I think as well, is You know, like, so with an iPhone, you know, everybody's filming their surgeries and filming every aspect of their life, which can be good and bad. I'd like to think that the majority of the physicians we know and nurse injectors and other companies within our industry are putting out, you know, truth and reality in terms of it being, yes, they are their patients, you know, pictures that they're showing, and yes, they are real results of before and afters. However, we know it's not exactly the truth, and we also know that with the perception, as you mention it now, is the perception is people seem to be, as we scroll, we're just looking for what we want to see, you know, and so we
And the wow factor is the thing that people look for, and they're, wow. I'll give you a common kind of thing that happens. And you know, you've been in the industry for a while, but you'll look at this tonight or tomorrow, Angela, and you'll say, yeah, they are doing that. So here's a common thing that injectors do, and it's really common among injectors. So if you think about it, you're looking at a picture of me now, and there's some light on my cheeks, and then there's a shadow in here, right? The light shadow interface on our face. Well, the way to make me look older is to relatively top light my face so that the shadows, the light shadow interfaces, come out more. So that's what people do with their before pictures.
Yeah.
And their after pictures, they direct the light. It's directly in the face. And that blunts out the light shadow interface. And so it used to be that I'd see people doing this a little, and they wouldn't try, they would try to hide it a little. Like they would try and say, well, I'm not going to do that blatantly. I'll just do it a little. And if you looked into the eyes, you can see where the light's coming from, the light reflection on the pupil. And it's different in the before and after. Now I look, and even masters, they don't care about being blatantly dishonest and making their photographs. If you lit my face differently right now, I'd look younger or older based on where that light's coming from.
Yeah.
And good photographers know about this.
Okay.
And they know how to do this. And now plastic surgeons and injectors and dermatologists and oculoplastic surgeons, and they know how to do this too. And what's a really common thing is for a doctor to show a before picture, and then they show the patient when they send in a selfie.
Oh, yeah.
No, we're lighting them really different, and the selfie is in the best position. The neck's up, the neck looks better. You know, women know how to do this. They're always putting their neck up, right? But they know about these things. You know, people understand how to make themselves look the best. If you're heavy and you're overweight, you don't show a picture of your whole body. You show a top picture of your head and your shoulders. You know, we know how to do these things. So doctors have figured out how to do these things with the little nuances of the face. I don't do body stuff, but I'm sure they do it with bodies as well. And it's become acceptable. It's there's no monitoring. I never want to put anything negative on the internet, but some of the time when somebody says, "What do you think of this great result?" I want to write into them and say, "You should learn to use a camera."
Yeah,
I'm not trying to be, you know, but you should, you know, you should make your photographs more consistent. Because if we think about it, if somebody were that, had that little attention to detail in their surgery or their injection as they do in their photography, we wouldn't want them as a surgeon or an injector, right? I think the attention's there. It's just with deceit. So I don't mean to sound so negative, because I'm in a profession that I love. I love doing what I do. So it's, and even with this, I still love it. I just, it's just a thing I'm noticing in the industry after many years of doing it. So.
Well, let me ask you, because, you know, obviously, we have talked about how Australia is making changes from a government level in terms of, you know, monitoring advertising and truth in advertising with plastic surgeons. And they have a whole list of criteria now that both patient and doctor or nurse have to go through in order to do any kind of cosmetic procedures. Now, I don't know if the USA or any other countries will follow suit with that. Well, let's say that they won't, you know, and especially in the USA, because we're so huge and it's such a, there's so many practitioners here, you know. But I would say the reason that Australia is doing this is because of complications and some horrific complications. And not necessarily even at the hands of what you consider good people who are taking pictures, you know, being a little scandalous on their pictures, but people who we would consider rogues, you know, rogue injectors, rogue surgeons.
I think that that they're trying to place external controls on how doctors use the internet and controlling what they're put out. And there's good and bad to that, too. I mean, we have an extremely powerful, in the U.S., First Amendment right. It says freedom of speech.
Yeah.
And it's good and it's bad. It's good in a lot of ways and it's bad in a lot of ways. The good part is people of every position, every walk of life get to use their phone and say whatever they want. And they get to, you know, the bad part is that people in power can theoretically say things and make themselves look as they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
But if you would ask me from a, do I think it will change in the U.S.? Do I think, absolutely I do not, because I think most people stand by the Bill of Rights, and I think we have a lot of advantages because we have freedom of speech, and we also we pay very, very dearly for our freedom of speech. I mean, I think that's what created the thing that happened January 6th a few years ago. That was freedom of speech and letting that go rampant. But how do you monitor that? It's a very tricky wicket as to how to deal with that. Should there be somebody that looks at every one of her posts and says, this is okay or it's not? No, I don't think so. I don't think anybody would love doing that. I don't think the internet would be as free-flowing as it is. So, you know, it's just what we have. But I think that each of us has to self-monitor. So the internet is, the thing I like about it is it tends to be an all positive thing. But occasionally there are negative things said, but most of them are positive. Yeah. You know, I put a result up, you know, and usually it's because it's a good result. People are really positively, you know, giving feedback with that.
Yeah.
And I think negative things are sort of shunned, but it might be good once in a while to have a negative thing. You know, that before and after doesn't look anything like the, but we don't get that. So it's very tricky, and it's not, there is not an easy answer to it. There's not, you know, certain things we don't have easy answers to. One is we need a little more control and monitoring, but once you let that go wild, then it gets too controlling. So we don't like control. We don't like somebody controlling what we say. So I mean,
who would you offer to? So if we have physicians and injectors who are kind of using some trick lighting to make things look more appealing to a patient, you know, is there anything in your educational seminars and sessions that you do that you share with the people you train?
I am actually about to go on and try and put some educational things on the internet about photography and give some examples. And in no way will I ever make the example of a poorly done one because it's against that person. I just want to educate the public to what they're looking at.
Yes.
Like, for instance, that little thing I said about top versus front lighting, you know, once somebody knows that, they'll look for it.
Yes.
The other thing, the other way to look at it is where is the light reflection in the pupil? And see sometimes where the light reflection is a single light and sometimes where it's very diffuse light and they're different. And you can look at the pupils of the patient before and after. You know, it's a very common thing. And I'm sure you haven't thought about this, Angela, but once you do, you'll say, yeah, it's that. So you'll see all people that want to be want to get big in the lip augmentation industry. And they show these before and after lips, right? They don't show the whole face at all. Oh. What do they normally do? They put a little makeup on the lips and they shine a bright light. So the lips reflecting all this light. There's never any lip reflection in the before. Never. Look tonight, Angela, when we get off the call, 10 before and afters of lips, and it will amaze you.
Yeah.
It will amaze you as to what is done. And now that's just become commonplace. It's sort of like, how do I prepare my after lip to make it look really good? They ought to be in the same kind of makeup and the same kind of lighting. Anyway, so it sounds like I'm on a rampage. I'm not.
No, but I think, but it is a change, and it is a change that is really significant. And especially, you know, in terms of a patient education, because all of us say, you know, we really do our best to educate a patient so they can make a sensible decision and make the right choice as to who is the correct injector or surgeon for them. But if you know, and hopefully by the time they do get to meet somebody, they perhaps see that the before and after pictures are not quite what they saw on their social media before they make a decision. But, you know, is that the case? I don't know.
There's a lot at stake for them, for each of them. And there's a lot of pressure on the young physician to get content, to be a content grabber, you know, and get content up right away. And because of that, the young, inexperienced physician, surgeon can get busy much faster, much faster. Because the advertising curve is different.
Yeah. Now, I do think there are some things at play in terms of, I think there was a female physician in like Ohio recently, and she actually lost her license, I think, forever in that state, because she was actually filming a surgery on the internet, like a live stream, and it was deemed that it was dangerous. And it was you know, HIPAA violation, and apparently she had multiple, you know, it was like after the third time that she, you know, told she can't do this and had a license, you know, suspended. I think eventually has become a permanent suspension in that state. So I think there's some regulation, but it's more with HIPAA compliance and patient safety than patient
honesty
manipulation, you know, really. If you are manipulating your photos and it's dishonest and it's, you know, it's not truthful. So there are some things at play, but I agree with you that we know. And we don't want to be monitored in the way Australia is monitoring. We don't have healthcare that they have in that country where they can impose the kind of restrictions that they have. We don't have that here. The other thing I have seen is surgeons I know, when they have posted a notice on their social media saying that somebody, not them, has taken their photos and is now using their photos on their website and claiming those as their results, which is not...
I think that happens a lot.
You know, and I'm seeing more of a trend with physicians putting watermarks on their photos. If that helps or not, I don't know. I mean, I guess if you've got a clever graphic artist, they can still take the watermarks out. But perhaps it's one more step they have to do in order to be able to use the photos. So what are you recommending to patients then in terms of, you know, like you know, if you're going to be teaching things that are more patient-oriented, what would you say to a patient who is scrolling the...
Well,
in wild factor?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things, but I think patients should try to document the credentials of the person and make sure they're valid and they're not. I think next, they ought to look at these before and afters with a little bit of a sideways eye to just make sure they're not getting a little duped. The next thing I think is it's really important to meet the surgeon in some way. And I do have some people that come to me from far away in Beverly Hills, and that's always a little more difficult for them and for me because I want to know them as well. I mean, the next part of what we're going to talk about is how to choose patients and how to, you know, and so I, I want to know my patients and I want them to know me. And sometimes, usually it's a very good fit, and occasionally it's not, on either direction. They don't like me, or they don't, you know, they don't. But I think that if you choose a surgeon, let's say, we're talking about that, that you think is good, they're going to be caring, and they're going to take care of you after surgery, not just do the surgery, but they're going to, you know, because they're always little issues, and they're going to deal with the little issues. The you know, it might be a little scar behind your ear with a facelift, or it might be, you know, some little part of one of your scars, or a little bump that's somewhere. The whole result's good, but there's one little thing, because we're doing something that the healing operation, right? And stuff happens, even when we're experienced and we control it really well. And I like to think the way I take care of people is the way people, I get, some people think I'm crazy for this, but I give all my patients my home phone number, my cellular number, or I'm a home phone, but you know, my cellular number, so they can reach me. And there's a trust that, that goes on with that, you know, but somebody that's going to take care of you when everything's not perfect. I don't want, you know, you want that you want someone that's going to be honest with you about their results with surgery. You know, you want somebody that says, well, you're having a breast augmentation. I'm picking that because I don't do it. And there's a 10% chance of this, or a 2% chance, and they're not changing that number to make it look better for them. You know, you want honesty. Yeah. We all crave honesty, you know, so that we can make a good decision. I can look somebody in the eye and say, I've done 6,500 rhinoplasties. And, you know, when I see somebody that's a year out and they say they've done, you know, 2,000, it's not possible. You know, so honesty is important.
Can we just touch for a moment on ChatGPT? Because, you know, we're talking about patient education, and of course now with AI, you know, the artificial intelligence and not aesthetic insider and the ChatGPT, that it's kind of is what you're reading, not just the photos, but what you're reading, which has been generated through, you know, as ChatGPT in terms of materials on somebody's website or through even through their social media. Have you had any experience with ChatGPT? Do you have any opinions or anything?
I've looked at it a few times. Yeah, I've looked at it a few times. I don't use it commonly, but I think I will in the future. Yes. But I think a lot of writing is getting done with this. You know, eighth graders have term papers, and they're getting their term paper done in ChatGPT. I've heard that in school, you know, they're not allowing you to take stuff home anymore to write an essay, that you've got to do it in the class, or, you know, and doctors are doing that. They're writing chapters on facelifts with ChatGPT. So they're probably writing some of the things on their website with that.
Yes.
Having said that, it's pretty amazing the information that's coming out of there. That's why they're getting away with writing a chapter on this. And so that may be more educational and hopefully less advertising, you know, but although somebody could use ChatGPT and then change it to their advertisement, change it to for their benefit. But so I only think it's going to get bigger and bigger. Yeah. ChatGPT, I think it's going to, we've only touched the surface of how individuals are going to use it. They're going to use it more and more and more and more, because it's the next step of a Google search. We did Google searches. Now nobody's going to Google search. They're just going to ChatGPT something, and they'll have the whole book on it or whatever. So it's the, you know, 20 years ago, what was a Google search? It wasn't, you know, so now people routinely do that. And I think in one day people are going to be taking out ChatGPT, and they're all two paragraphs on whatever they want to know, how to, you know, how to caulk their tile, or, you know, whatever. It's just going to be there for them. So I see it getting used more and more, and I see it as an inevitable. Yeah.
It's kind of like the standing joke of Dr. Google. When a patient comes in, like, oh yeah, you've been talking to Dr. Google. He's going to be talking to Dr. ChatGPT.
I have this somebody made me a coffee mug, and it's and it says, "Don't confuse your 1 hour search on Google with my medical degree."
Yes.
But anyway, you get. But it's better than what we had before, which was nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think, again, because we've been kind of at this for a long time now, and I know for me, in all of my, past experience of life in media and television and practice consulting, it's always been with the benefit of educating the patient. It definitely was, we are working to bring more patients to the practice, and we are doing things within the practice to create an experience that is superior, so that those referrals, which is what we kind of all based in business even, the majority of business referrals did come from referrals. Now it seems a lot of it is like sort of Instagram, it's social media, influencers, so it has changed a lot. Do you think there's anything else within our industry that beyond social media that has changed for the good or the bad?
Well, I'll get to that in a second. I just want to make one comment about what you just said, which I like, and that is the trying to do education for patient. I mean, when we educate our patients, honestly, it strengthens the relationship, because they get to know us better. They get to know what they're having better. They get to make informed decisions better. They get to know what to expect after the procedure that they have, whatever that is.
Yeah.
All of that is good. And educate. So it sounds like I'm poo-pooing education. I mean, I was in education as a facial plastic surgeon for over 25 years, and I still give lots of lectures. I love educating, but it's very interesting. Now more people want to educate that didn't want to educate before, because there's more opportunity in marketing with our education because of the internet. But to me, I'm a strong, strong believer that educating patients is the way to build organic trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we want in our patients, and what we want for them to trust us, and we want to trust them. So we want that communication kind of relationship, that we just want that. So are things changing? I think things are changing a lot now. And I think the next big thing in what we're doing will be ChatGPT. And, we'll be asking, who are the good surgeons, or who are the good, and I don't know how they're going to figure that out, but people will be looking to get up the search level in ChatGPT. That will have its own new algorithms. I think all of this for us is circled around two things. One of them is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the restrictions that are placed or not placed on that, like First Amendment rights. Almost everything we've talked about thus far sits in those two things.
Yes.
Even how a patient grades their result has internet basis, and their reviews, what they say about you, how then the next patient gets information about you. It's all internet based now. Nobody says, "Well, I'm gonna put an ad at that surgeon in the newspaper." We don't do that, because that would be gone right away. And I want to thank them. I want to do something good for them. I read a review that sits out there for a long time. It's a very interesting world. It's a curious world. I mean, for me, I just love doing my craft. I'm just the internet world is swirling around what I love doing, which is doing my craft. And because for me, it's a joy love for me to doing it. So,
but and when you say that, you think about to create that content. And that much content is so time consuming. And
cool.
I have to say, how much time, and not you, but those that are just, there's constant new content being created every day. When do they do surgery?
I think they do it at the same time.
They do it at the same time, yeah.
I don't love when I, unless I'm doing it for true education to talk about a procedure, but I don't love the interruptions that social media make in my surgery. I don't love that. No. But I do it. I don't know if you know, but I'm a big stock investor, like large stock, and I trade stocks almost every day. And I'm a Warren Buffett fan. And he said something that's very interesting that I watched on TV once. He was giving this forum to graduate students at the University of Washington. And somebody, he was probably 82 at the time. He's about 90 now. And somebody said to him, how do you stay current? And how do you, he said, well, marketing and invention and new things are like watching a parade. And I'm thinking, what does he mean by that? He said, well, I call it the tippy toe phenomenon. If you want to get an advantage, you have to stand on your tippy toes, right? Think of that and what we do, what you do, Angela, and every day of your marketing and your, you have to stand on your tippy toes. He said, but then after a while, everybody's on their tippy toes. So you have to bring a box. You have to stand on a box. So you get the analogy. You've got to always be changing, right? That, frankly, for me, I've changed a lot in my surgical skills. And so I'm doing well in that. But I don't do as well in the marketing world because that's not what I'm intrinsically good at. I'm just not. And many surgeons are intrinsically good at it. It's not what I do well. And I don't have any very bad intentions for people that do it well. It's just not what I do well. So I feel really good. I go to a lot of meetings and after many, many years of doing something, I'm always changing what I'm doing. But marketing for me has always been a more difficult thing because I'm just intrinsically not good at it. So,
well, whether it's luck on your side or it's just the continued hard work, but it seems to be something's working right.
So. Yeah, hard work has helped for me.
Well, let's talk about the patient psychology because, you know, that is something I think, at least on both sides, whether it's the patient not being the right patient for you or you not being the right physician for the patient. So how can we educate and share information on understanding the patient psychology and the right candidate for a procedure?
It's really important for both doctor and patient or nurse and patient to choose each other. And a lot of times we get wrapped up in the economics of it and think, well, I don't want to lose this patient. What I teach young surgeons, young physicians is at the end of your career, you'll never be upset that you did not operate on a patient. You may be very upset that you did operate on a patient, but you'll never be upset that you didn't because we don't know all the people that we don't operate on. I never would say, oh, this, you know, somebody came into my office and I didn't do her, sir. That's fine with me. There are plenty of other people to do that. So that's one of the things that gets in our way. The other thing that gets in our way are our egos. Egos and economics are the two things that get in the way of people when they choose. Okay. And we can be better at it by listening to patients more, both in the before procedure and after, but certainly in the before part. I have this slide. I give a lot of talks about psychology. I have this slide that shows Kanye West interrupting Taylor Swift when she's receiving some award. I forget what it was years ago, but it was sort of a famous picture. And I put up there, by the way, physicians interrupt their patients on average 8 seconds after they begin speaking. That's the average, 8 seconds. So what that means is we don't listen well. We don't listen to what they, because we have an agenda. It might be to find out what they want, find out this, you know, and we try to move the conversation along. We don't listen to them. And that's how we find out who they are. So we're often spend too much time telling them who we are and how good we are and what we're going to do to them. And we don't find out anything about who they are. And they, at least as a plastic surgeon, the biggest indicator on whether somebody's going to be satisfied or not is not what I choose to do on them, and not what I do to them. It's how they are.
Yeah.
That's the biggest indicator of being a satisfied versus an unsatisfied patient. If I have an angry patient, a patient who tends to not love life, not be optimistic about life, I'm probably not going to, even if I did, had my 99% result, which you can't get your 99% result on everybody, it wouldn't be the 99% result. But let's say I had my 99%, they probably won't be happy because, as George Carlin said in his comedy routine many years ago, you know, he said, that's it, you won a 1971 Ferrari. And he goes, oh shit, I have a small car. You know, the guy won a Ferrari and he didn't like that because he, you know, he wouldn't like whatever you gave him. So some of our patients, we can't make them happy with whatever we do. So, but we don't find that out. So that's we can find that out if we listen and we talk to them when we find out who they are. And I'll often ask them sort of an open-ended kind of question to find out their security level and who they are. I might ask them something like, how much per day do you think about your appearance? And, you know, most people think about it a little bit when they pass the mirror, but some of my body dysmorphic patients are thinking about their appearance a lot of the day. It's very hard to make them happy. So I want to find that out before surgery. This is a whole lesson and thing. But so part of it is selecting. And then in the cases where you think you can't make them happy, I won't say deselecting, but telling them at least, I don't think I can make you happy. I mean, I say that to some people occasionally. I don't think I can get you what you want. Sometimes they're annoyed, but usually they're just annoyed and they move on. At least I haven't, as I like to say, you know, a consult is like courting. Surgery is like marriage. You get the analogy. It's not exactly like that, but you can't, there's not an easy back out after you've done surgery on someone. You know, the first of all, they have scars, they've got stuff, they've got something changed, you know. So you've got to look at that as an important relationship.
It's almost like speed dating, you know. It's like they're rushing through each exam room, seeing a patient. 8 seconds in, they're giving their opinion, then they move on to the next one. Versus, you know, perhaps enjoying your first date just a little bit longer to get to know the person.
Yeah, it's you know, it depends what we're doing to the patient. If it's botulinum toxin, if it's a Botox injection, that's sort of a shorter relationship kind of thing. But if I'm going to do an eyelids and a facelift on somebody, that's a longer relationship. I'm going to see that patient many, many times. And the I have to have somebody that I sort of like a little bit, and I'd like it if they sort of like me. I mean, we don't have to be bosom buddies or anything, but we, you know, you've got to be able to stand the other person, and you've got to listen to them, and they've got to listen to you. So if everything you're saying before a procedure, they seem to know, they're sort of blowing you off, they're really going to do that after the procedure. If they're not listening to you before the procedure, they're really not going to listen after.
Are there any warning signs for you, like, you know, for a practitioner anyway, kind of in warning signs of patients that you may have about it or negative experience with post procedure?
I find people that are really know-it-alls before, like, they know everything and they know what they want and they've got their own agenda. And listen, the procedure is about them, so I want them to know what they want. But there are these know-it-all kind of people that are generally not going to mix when, you know, somebody's numb in an area and they should be, and they already know that they shouldn't be. You know, they think they shouldn't be. They know that. And they know more than you do, or they read something. So that's a difficult kind of patient. Sometimes overly complimentary patients to me, or that's a little bit of a minor red flag, because when they compliment me more than they should, I know you're the best, Dr. Sykes. How the hell do you know that? You know, that's, you know, it's, you can't know that. And they just keep doing that. So that's not good. I mean, we want them to like us and respect us, but there is a limit. They're you know, the borders for all these things.
Are there any other things, you know, to a patient who is the right kind of patient, the kind of patient you want? Any advice to them in selecting the right surgeon?
Get somebody that you feel like you can trust, who's doing more than just doing surgery, but taking care of you as an individual. And that's what I would say, because this, many times patients will say to me, well, I don't care if they're a good surgeon. I don't care if they're a jerk. That's not true, because not everything is perfect in all this. It wouldn't matter. You could be a technician, but we're not just technicians. This is not just about, because we have to agree about a lot of things. They've got to listen to me about what I want them to do preoperatively, what I want them to do postoperatively. We've got to have a, you know, we've got to have a bond in that kind of way where we trust each other. And when I've found, and we could go next to the patient who's dissatisfied, when I've found that it's difficult postoperatively or post-injection or post-anything, it's when the trust goes away. So.
That's great. Well, any final words, anything else that you would like to share with our audience before we close out this evening?
Well, I can say that, you know, it sounds like a lot of what I've talked about here is negative. I'm not a negative guy at all. You know me pretty well, Angela, and I'm not a, no. I'm actually, there's nobody that's more high on their career than I am. I feel like I've led a glorious career in medicine, like that. I just chose the thing that I might like the best. And for that reason, I'm going to do it to a very late age in my life. Because I love doing it. It's not for me about money at this point in my life. It's about, you know, just enjoying what I do, enjoying my craft, as I like to say. But so, and I would tell people out there, I don't know who's watching, but choose something in life that you really enjoy doing every day, because it won't seem like work. And you'll, you know, I see so often people that if somebody give them a little bit of money, they'd stop working. That's never going to happen with me. Nobody can buy me out of work, because I like doing what I do. Some of my friends say I don't relax enough, but I'm going to relax at work. So it's good. So, and thank you, Angela, for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for everything you do too, Angela. Thank you.
And for those listeners and viewers that are still with us, remember to watch next Wednesday for another exciting episode of the Aesthetic Insider Show. Thank you.